Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and the production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
Long before the era of Harvey Weinstein, I was totally ashamed of my love of Shakespeare in Love, which some people, usually too young to have ever seen it except on TV for 10 minutes at a time, they name it the worst best picture of all time. Now, whether or not it is, and seriously, there are much worse, Gladiator anybody, it is forever the epitome of the bought Academy Award. Harvey Weinstein bought a dream team of Hollywood publicists, not just to publicly advertise for Shakespeare in Love, but to go to Hollywood parties and talk about how great the movie is. And the campaign costs at least $5 million. Now, this movie's purplish prose is often quoted by young movie lovers to demonstrate just how stupid it is. The one I'm about to read is one of the most embarrassing quotes ever allowed into a great movie, and there are probably a dozen of these howlers in Shakespeare in Love. "Not the artful postures of love, but love that overthrows life. Unbiddable, ungovernable, like a riot in the heart, and nothing to be done come ruin or rapture. Love as there has never been in a play. I will have love, or I will end my days." The great musician Thomas Beecham once said that the arts in America are a racket run by unscrupulous men for unhealthy women. Now, let's just be a literal uncharitable to a number of people here. This is, to be likely, a sentiment which a lot of middle-class people view from the Victorian era up to the Eisenhower, and they would probably view it as typical of Shakespeare, especially women, because they had very little option but to stay in their homes and obviously had more time to devote to the arts. Now, many middle-class people still view the arts as a kind of suppository for the high passion they never got from their dull spouses who lost interest in them 20 years ago, and to be fair, there's a certain amount of that in Shakespeare. Nobody in real life falls in love as quickly as actors in Shakespeare do, except other actors. And this kind of outsized passion isn't exactly unique in great art to Shakespeare either, but in this movie, these sentiments are obviously a very cynical tug at the heartstrings of old retirees of both genders who want to feel young again. Now, we can't get around it. There is a very cynical side to Shakespeare in Love, and it plays on old notions of love that recent generations of America have completely discarded. Now, a lot of people have an allergic reaction to sad comedies, which seem so soulful that they tug at your heartstrings even as they make you laugh. Because something so human inevitably has something hypocritical about it. Just think about a couple examples. You know, Woody Allen made these immortal, supposedly tragic comedies about adult relationships while he was assaulting a little girl. John Lasseter, we now find out, made immortal comedies about child relationships when he was assaulting adult women. Aaron Sorkin wrote tragic comedies about the dreams of liberals while being completely blind to how he was negating women. And, you know, Frank Capra made tragic comedies about American patriotism, and he was completely blind to how he was negating people of foreign origin. Now, whatever particular cynicism is your hot-button issue, you're going to see right through the white lies of these movies and the TV shows, and it will inhibit your enjoyment. Now, it doesn't mean that these works are actually bad, but it does mean that there's probably a flaw in each of them that stands out. Nobody who's seen a lot of Woody Allen movies can fail to notice the Pygmalion complex, where he inevitably tries to teach his girlfriends and form them into the kind of woman he wants. And nobody watches an Aaron Sorkin show should fail to notice how he uses women as the more ignorant party in a conversation so the men can charismatically explain the real truth to them. And for the moment, let's not even get started on Pixar or Disney. But there's something cynical and exploitative about all of those works. It doesn't make them bad, but let's not pretend they're Shakespeare either. Now, in the same way that Disney panders to children, Shakespeare in Love panders to the elderly. It was not a movie made for people my age, and it's a movie made for people who are old enough to have a prettified view of the British, you know, who grew up when there was still remnants of the old Europe aristocracy and before the tabloid scandals of Chuck and Di. And, you know, when they go to sleep at night, I'm sure many of them dreamed of a high society world, David Niven, Audrey Hepburn, Deborah Kerr, Robert Donath. You know, think of the ballroom or the cocktail lounge where Noel Coward or Evil Novello is playing the piano. Everybody's dressed immaculately, always has the perfectly placed bon mot, which is the the humdrum realities of middle-class America are all left behind because you now have servants who are ministering downstairs to your needs. And most importantly, these people have very vivid memories of seeing Laurence Olivier's movie version of Henry V in 1944. Olivier's Henry V was practically a British victory party, and the opening scenes recreated the Globe Theatre, which probably premiered all of the plays in the second half of Shakespeare's career, never mind that the Globe Theatre had yet to be built for another 5 years when Shakespeare wrote either Henry V or Romeo and Juliet. But for the first time since Henry V, we get a real view of the Elizabethan world from which this perfectly placed hair and vowels that you get in high society was made. Now, one of the great things about Shakespeare in Love is how blatantly it shows that this glamorous world of highfalutin speech begins in a Warwickshire house. Now, to me, the archetypal line of dialogue from Shakespeare in Love is when Shakespeare says to the producer, played by Geoffrey Rush, "My muse, as always, is Aphrodite," to which Geoffrey Rush replies, "Aphrodite Baggett, who does it behind the door and crumpet." Forgive my horrible British accent. Now, in its way, Shakespeare in Love, as you can see just from that quote, is brutally honest about the corrupted ideals that go into making every piece of art we love. I'm sure I don't need to tell you again that everything about Shakespeare in Love now somewhat reeks, and I'm sure I needn't tell you of whom, but the enjoyment of every dirty pun, every lofty phrase, even the most genuine parts of the movie, which show how commerce and compromise and disaster can wreck even Will Shakespeare, are partially spoiled by knowing that Harvey Weinstein's corrupting hands are all over it. Now, the original concept is by Mark Norman, who was a screenwriter whom, from all other appearances, is a hack. His other big credit is Cutthroat Island, which is one of the biggest cinematic bombs of the 90s. He's a California screenwriter who literally works his way up from the mailroom in the 60s, and since Shakespeare in Love, he hasn't had a single screen credit. Now, apparently the idea wasn't even his. It was his son's who called home one day in the late 80s from college with it. Now, it's possible that nobody but a Hollywood hack would have the idea of taking one of the world's most famous works of art and showing how commerce completely polluted it. And maybe on some level he meant it as a justification for his career, but regardless, I'm sure that the half of the movie which feels like a prim housewife's view of love and Shakespeare is his. Now, the other half of it carries the kind of ironies that feel written by Shakespeare himself, and I think we can reasonably assume that that half was written by the co-writer, Tom Stoppard, who was maybe the greatest living English playwright even then, and how much more so now. So let's take this a little further. Tom Stoppard is a rarity in the world of the British arts because he's such an establishment figure. Stoppard came over from Czechoslovakia as a child refugee from the Holocaust, and even now, his extreme upper-class accent still has a weird Eastern European tinge. Now, Stoppard is different from the average playwright in all sorts of ways, but the one that exists above all is that the theater has always been a refuge for the different, who don't fit in with conventional society, and almost all modern playwrights who even have a small political interest have all been usually been extremely far to the left. Think of Harold Pinter, Arthur Miller, Tony Kushner, Bertolt Brecht, even Henrik Ibsen. Now, Stoppard, on the other hand, is a bona fide conservative. He's not necessarily a reactionary, but he's certainly a conservative in the sense of a Margaret Thatcher supporter and a clarion voice in the press for dissident Eastern European writers whom fate allowed him to leave behind for a very plush life in England. So on the one hand, Stoppard is the most intellectually ambitious playwright maybe ever. He's very funny. He doesn't care much about the way of character development and human motivations. And like in Bernard Shaw, the characters are really just mouthpieces for the exposition of his ideas. But the ideas are genuinely complex and interesting. Now, as many of you know, he began his career with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead, which is literally Hamlet from the point of view of its two least consequential characters. Now, in later plays, he asks us to care about things like the repressed homosexuality of A.E. Housman, or to sit for 8 hours for a disquisition on the formation of the 19th century Russian intelligentsia, or sit through a play that's basically an exchange of ideas between James Joyce, Lenin, and the inventor of Dadaism. But a certain kind of audience, an extremely sophisticated London audience that grew up watching plays by Bernard Shaw and Oscar Wilde, they eat it up. You know, something with real ideas is manna from heaven if you're bored with the usual theater, which is either musicals or claustrophobic family dramas or sermons about capitalism. But Stomper doesn't really translate well in America, even if some audiences might be able to get the extreme plethora of references and ironic snark. I think it's safe to say that the actors in America certainly don't. I don't even think that Stopper, personally, is even the greatest living playwright in England. For me, that's Ellen Ackbourne, and find a YouTube production, if you can, of the Norman Chronicles cycle, if you get a chance, because Ackbourne is a playwright of real humanity. But I doubt that Stoppard will ever be completely forgotten, and in our age when knowledge of cultural history is thought of as the least necessary thing on the planet, his stock will go down for a while. Now, on the other hand, Stoppard has worked as a hired screenwriter, most famously on Shakespeare in Love, but also some very different kinds of political work than the usual, like Terry Gilliam's Brazil, which is a science fiction that takes place in a dystopia that seems much more like an exaggerated Soviet Union than the usual exaggerated United States. And he also worked on Spielberg's adaptation of Empire of the Sun by G.G. Ballard, about an upper-class British boy becoming a POW in a Japanese internment camp. And that's a movie that almost dares right-wingers to crow, and you think we're bad. And then you add to that the rumors that Stoppard was a hired screenwriter who wrote drafts of not just movies everybody knew would be a hit, like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, but movies everybody knew would be a flop, like Revenge of the Friggin' Sith. Now, there is no writer in the English language more highbrow than Tom Stoppard, and because of that, he has no trouble slumming into the commercial world, and he knows that his credentials against selling out accusation are completely unassailable. And what, ultimately, is Shakespeare in Love about? Now, much more so either than love or love of art, it's about business. It has this ridiculous glorification of love at its center, so it can surround the center with a very stark look at how the sausage gets made and the extreme dangers of keeping your illusions about how beauty is used. And from this mixture of trash romance and serious business, we get a real work of art that does Shakespeare some small level of justice. Now, Stoppard really is that good, but I have a hard time believing that anyone would think of him as a genius on the level of Shakespeare. Artistic genius, real artistic genius, you know, the kind that can literally conjure any person, place, or thing, that's very rare. It probably only happens a dozen times every century. And how many of them actually created for the theater? You know, Shakespeare and maybe Chekhov and Moliere. If you count musical lyricists, then certainly Stephen Sondheim. If you count composers, it's Mozart, maybe Leos Janáček, whom nobody but classical music lovers know about. And then I draw another blank. Certainly, there are one-hit wonders that have moments of genius, but a theatrical creator who has a whole career of genius, the way Shakespeare and Sondheim did, the way Mozart might have if he lived longer than 35, it's clearly something that only happens, say, once every 200 years. Shakespeare is Shakespeare because he can give us every kind of person in every situation, rational and irrational, tragic and comic, sublime and vulgar. Whatever situation Shakespeare comes up with, he can also come up with its opposite. But in Tom Stoppard, God forbid, there's any vulgarity. And that is a great limitation. So many great Hollywood movies are happy accidents of chemistry in which a limited talent finds another limited talent that completes them perfectly. Now, Shakespeare in Love completes Tom Stoppard. It gives him the vulgarity he needs to create something that, you know, if it isn't better than his debates of Czech intellectuals behind the Iron Curtain or 19th century drawing room conversations about physics, it's at least more universal. I doubt many people have the mind or stomach to properly appreciate Arcadia or Coast of Utopia, but a story that deposits Shakespeare into situations that mirror Romeo and Juliet, this is something that everybody who loves Romeo and Juliet can love. Now, the problem with that is that in the last generation or so, there is no play by Shakespeare whose fortunes have changed quite the way Romeo and Juliet has. I can't tell you how many people I've met, and one must say, almost all of them are women, who have an extremely jaundiced view of this play, which is probably the world's most famous play. There are all sorts of things in Romeo and Juliet, or at least Romeo and Juliet as it's traditionally been interpreted, that do not seem to translate to this generation. Look up everything wrong in Romeo and Juliet on Google and it auto-completes. You'll get think piece after think piece, and it'll seemingly be by every English major in the world. And there are multiple think pieces about how Romeo is actually the villain, either a casual seducer or a creepy stalker. And of course, the play has an antiquated notion of virginity's importance, and Friar Lawrence seems to be a character who is the precise incarnation of everything considered offensive in our zeitgeist. You know, he's a Catholic priest who marries underage couples, prescribes them potions that seem uncannily like date rape drugs, and he's a centrist who wants to bring the two irreconcilable parts of the state together in an understanding. Now, all these R&J haters aren't wrong. They're just not completely right either. A great work of art is great because there are thousands of meanings that take thousands of years to reveal themselves. Just take Friar Lawrence's introduction, Act 2, Scene 2, and try to unpack the dual meanings in it. Every sentiment in it is balanced by its opposite. I'm not going to read it, but, you know, the idea, he talks about two such opposed kings, and then there are oppositional words just over and over again, night and morning, frowns and smiles, weeds and flowers, tombs and wombs, fair use and abuse, virtue and vice, poison and medicine. Right after the balcony scene, the end of Romeo and Juliet is hinted at right there. Everything which centuries of audiences and readers find so moving about the balcony scene is exactly what will eventually kill the star-crossed lovers. Every great virtue is also a great vice. Implicit in every sweet thing is poison. Therefore, Romeo is both the epitome of love and a seductive creep. Juliet's virginity is both a great prize and a senselessly valued thing that imprisons her. Friar Lawrence is both a very wise and loving man and an evil fool with bad ideas. No concept in the world can ever exist in a vacuum. Just like morality always evolves, meaning always evolves and often cycles. Because, you know, Shakespeare can conjure every kind of person in every kind of place. He expresses every idea, so he can also conjure the interrelation between all of them. So in the case of Shakespeare, every great text always takes on new meanings and outlives every intellectual system that means to interpret it with any kind of finiteness. Critics have reminded us for the better part of two centuries that Shakespeare is Shakespeare because he anticipates our changes in morality and is ready with a new way we can interpret his work. He's an infinite staircase we'll always be climbing. Now, Shakespeare in Love, on the other hand, is beginning to look like the vulgarities are pulling it into history's dustbin. I still think it's a great movie, but if Harvey Weinstein hasn't killed its reputation forever, then converting it into a play just might. Now, as of this year, Shakespeare in Love has been being rewritten as a play, and Fair Baltimore, where we lay our scene, is just one of 15 American cities that host regional productions of it this year alone. Don't let anybody tell you that good theater is impossible outside of capital cities. It's certainly less possible, but regional theater can be great, and bad theater is certainly possible in New York and London. It's just a lot more expensive. In any event, this risible show cost $20, and while it wasn't the worst spectacle I'd ever seen, it was among the more depressing. You know, it combines the worst of Shakespeare productions, the hammy, fast-paced physical shtick that shows directors think Shakespeare is incapable of standing on his own, and the wooden, uncomprehending acting, and it also combines that with the worst of regional touring productions, you know, the money-strewn overproduction with money put into lighting and scenery effects rather than hiring good actors. Now, when you put a movie on a stage, you're expecting people to come so they can relive what they loved about the movie, which then means that the stage show can never take a free life of its own outside of what the movie already does better than the stage show ever could. Now, if you go on Wikipedia, it would seem that there are 195 musicals based on movies. Now, that's not just famous ones like The Producers and Spamalot, but everything from Frozen to School of Rock to Reefer Madness to Debbie Does Dallas has been made into a musical in recent years. And as you can see, a lot of the adapted movies are very recent. But some of them are revived classics, though I don't know if you could call Reefer Madness a classic. I'm sure some of these musicals are very good. A lot of talented people put a lot of skill into these adaptations. And of course, most of them come from very good source material. That's the other half of why this concept became so successful so quickly. But what's undeniable is that every film made into a musical supplants money that could be given to an original concept. Now, since a lot of these productions are meant to be enfranchised to many cities, a lot more thought and money is put into production design than is ever put into the script, and certainly a lot more money is put and time is put into production design that's ever put into the acting. Now, Hollywood movies are in very serious trouble. If it isn't a superhero movie, it rarely ever grosses serious money, and even a lot of these superhero movies bomb. Now, it would seem that Hollywood, you know, the original concepts are growing drier every year, and it's finding a way to recreate the old glories, in part by selling them to producers who will make them into musicals. And more, because of that, Hollywood seems to be killing the originality of theater in addition to movies, too. Now, this year was the arrival of Shakespeare in Love. Next year will be the arrival of Network, and the new stage adaptation of that great movie is probably going to be touring in the exact same 15 American cities, and it'll sell just as many tickets to older Americans. They're all now nostalgic for an era when all they had to be mad as hell about was the upcoming Carter presidency. Now, the decline of Hollywood is a much bigger problem than either Harvey Weinstein or Hollywood's potential takeover of theater. Now, as of 2015, the arts account for $698 billion of the U.S. economy. That's 4.3% of the U.S.'s gross domestic product. 4.7 million people are employed in the arts. We in the arts do more for the American economy than construction, tourism, transportation, travel, and agriculture. Hollywood, you know, with all its movies, advertising, distribution, video services, production, it's probably responsible for somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of all the arts in America. And most importantly, thanks to Hollywood, the arts are one of the only industries in America that exports much more than it imports. Now, is there any other industry in America that has a $25 billion trade surplus? Millions of people depend on Hollywood for their work, and if Hollywood declines, millions can get laid off. And there's neither movies or theater in America that can afford to pay them much of anything for their services. But nobody wants to know the nightmares that go into manufacturing great art. But let's be honest, the nightmares are voluminous and deep and terrifying. 100 years of men have known that if they want to satisfy any craving, all they have to do is go to Hollywood, get on the C-list, and dangle a role in front of a struggling actor. And when they reach the A-list, they don't even have to dangle. They can just assume that the satisfaction will come to them, and if it doesn't, they can take it. Now, Hollywood was built and sustained on the objectification of women. I have serious doubts it can survive women's humanization. And who can pretend that Hollywood deserves to? Hollywood movies themselves are a 20th century concept that has long since outlived its usefulness. It's based on a kind of faux glamour that was outmoded by the late 60s. But Hollywood has already outlived its glory for 50 years. One of the first tales I wrote in my other big writing project, Tales from the Old New Land, my podcast mega novel, I don't know exactly what it is, about the nature of Judaism. It's the story, the third tale is the story of a Hollywood producer who was a chronic abuser of women. And in moments of particular savagery, he would quote all kinds of Jewish texts. Now, I think this works because we all know the archetype. The Jewish Hollywood producer is such a stock character in the American imagination, I don't need to explain it. But the whole world knows exactly what Hollywood producers are particularly known for doing long before these latest scandals. Now, meanwhile, Hollywood has become a caricature of itself, because in Hollywood movies, commerce has completely subsumed art for the last 35 years. TV is the only place that still seems to be going very well, but if the Hollywood golden age of the 70s is any indication, that's not going to last very long either. Now, there was a period, about maybe 16 to 18 years over the late 60s to early 80s, when art finally looked like it triumphed over commerce in Hollywood. Hollywood turned the keys to the Dream Factory over to a series of brilliant young men fresh out of film school, and they let them make exactly the kind of pictures which these brilliant youngsters wanted to make. Now, it says something about the quality of the product that so many of the implicated sexual harassers and assaulters have been, these old men whom, when they were young, ruled the world's most important art form like gods. Woody Allen and Roman Polanski, of course, but also James Toback, Oliver Stone, Dustin Hoffman, Richard Dreyfuss, even Al Franken, who started work on Saturday Night Live in 75. Now, when Molly Ringwald talked about a film director who kissed her when she was 14, the director she was working with at that age was Paul Mazursky. Now, except for Dustin Hoffman and Al Franken, these are names whose luster has faded in recent decades. They're of an ethos that no longer exists in Hollywood or anywhere else. They're liberals formed by the Mad Men era, and if they're pressed about their behavior, they'd probably justify it by saying that their accusers have a prudish and conservative conception of sex. For nearly half a century, most liberals and leftists did exactly that. They rejected any kind of sexual censure, and they said that this was the kind of sexual policing that leads to sexual repression. And we have to face the fact that to many older leftists, both men and women, though obviously especially men, this kind of talk about the line of consent and sexual power dynamics doesn't just seem strange, it seems outright destructive. And if you talk to them, I guarantee you'll get an earful about it. But these are the movie makers that Harvey Weinstein spent his career working with. Now, I suppose I have to give the proviso, in case it isn't blindingly obvious, that in no way should this be seen as an excuse for their behavior. There's no reason to ever feel sorry for anybody with lots of money and power. They have their whims satisfied for decades, and with power comes the inevitable abuse of power. It's one thing to shame the sins of the powerless, but when the powerful are stripped of their power for a good reason, we should all just yawn. Now, there are two reasons I love Shakespeare in Love. One is because it shows so well how difficult it is to create something worthwhile. No artist is in control of the work we produce. We don't dictate to the art. The art dictates to us. And while the stereotype of the suffering artist isn't popular these days, you don't create great art because you want to. You create great art because you have to. Nobody else would put themselves through this terrible stress and suffering and setbacks of creating new things unless they need an outlet for the hole in their lives that nothing else can fill. If you're not working out some kind of hell in your life while you're creating something, whether it's an art or politics or business or any other field where the risk is high, you're probably not creating much that's very good. The other is that in spite of glorifying an utterly false, prettified version of love, Shakespeare in Love also holds a mirror to the terrible dangers inherent in it. The world hasn't moved on from the age when women were bought and sold for marriage like cattle nearly as much as we think it has. Love itself is and will always be a completely dangerous state of mind. It doesn't just break hearts forever, but it puts some people in mortal peril. And it always amazes me that love still exists in a world where hatred is so much more common and the imbalances of power between lovers can be so obvious. But all of these states are inherent in love, and because love is a state in which we get selfish in our desire to pursue the other person at the same time that we want to selflessly give them part of ourselves, it's literally the desire to renounce part of ourselves and make ourselves part of a larger whole. And evolutionarily, what better explanation of love can there be than that? We can't stop ourselves from loving any more than we can stop ourselves from hating. And as Friar Lawrence said, one state of mind inevitably leads to the other.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, A History of the Distant Present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2017, AS21 Media, LLC, all rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?